Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, and on the occasion of the release of Ellen the Red Fox Reed, Pressman par excellence, which has just been released. And we have here today one of the co-authors of the book. Stephen Holt's going to speak for us on the topic of Ellen Reed and the 36 Faceless Men, and then we'll have questions and discussion. So the book is co-authored by Stephen Holt and Ross Fitzgerald. And Stephen Holt, our speaker tonight, is the Canberra-based historian and speechwriter. His biography of Manning Clark was published in 1999. He's also done a biography of the trade union leader Lloyd Ross, which was favourably reviewed in the Australian Book Review by me at some time. So it's a good book. And he works as a policy officer in the public service. He's drafted speeches and letters for various ministers, including Joe Hockey and Julia Gillard, but he doesn't respond to any of them, just drafts them. But today, Stephen Holt is going to speak for us on Ellen Reed and the 36 Faceless Men. Stephen Holt, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Gerard, for inviting me to speak on Ellen Reed and the 36 Faceless Men. Keen students of Australian political history always need to bear in mind that the people whose deeds they find so fascinating may no longer be remembered by the wider public. So let me begin by stating some personal and political facts about the journalist Ellen Reed. They are drawn from the brand new biography of Reed written by Ross Fitzgerald, who's on my right here, and myself, and copies are available to be signed after this presentation. And the biography indicates that Ellen Reed was born in Liverpool, England, in 1914. His father was a sea captain, and his mother was a daughter of a publican. His parents migrated to Australia in the 1920s. Reed's formal education ended when he received his leaving certificate from Waverley College in Sydney, but he was a studious reader all his life. His favourite authors as a teenager included Gibbon and Kipling. In 1923, Reed became a copy boy, the lowest form of journalistic life, on the Sydney Sun. Mentored by the leading Sun journalist Mary Marlowe, once well known, Reed progressed to being a cadet reporter. Though young and inexperienced, he did not go unnoticed. He was a brash redhead and cut a striking figure when clad in a reporter's trench coat. In 1937, Reed became the Sun's political reporter, and within a few years, he was one of the nation's top political journalists. In 1940, Reed married Joan Drummond. They had three children, at least one of whom are here tonight, his son Alan. Reed's career continued to thrive in the Cold Year wars after the Second World War. In 1954, he published the first ever detailed media articles about B.A. Santa Maria, now best remembered or currently remembered as the man who later sparked Tony Abbott's interest in politics. In the same year, he was headhunted by the Daily Telegraph, whose owner, Frank Packer, was, for various reasons, a stalwart supporter of Prime Minister Robert Menzies. Reed's most famous single story ever appeared in the Daily Telegraph in 1963. The Australian Labor Party, readers of the story were told, was controlled by 36 faceless men assembled at meetings of the party's national conference. Reed's story, enlivened by photographs, provided a graphic commentary on the, quote, decline in status of Labor's parliamentary leadership stop. Between 1969 and 1976, Reed published three chronicles of political history, which covered prime ministerial fallibility in the years between the disappearance of Harold Holt and the dismissal of Gough Whitlam. Earlier, Reid tried without success to publish a political novel inspired by his Florentine role model, Nicholas Machiavelli. Reid, like Machiavelli, was part cynic and part idealist. Reid's journalistic career continued to thrive under Malcolm Fraser and Bob Hawke. His health failing, he was forced to retire in 1985 and died 2 years later. Now, Reid loved his life as a political journalist. He was energised and excited by exposure to political power. Energy and excitement are certainly the words that spring to mind when we look at exactly how and why he came to write his famed exposé of Labour's 36 faceless men, the subject of tonight's talk. I'll just set the scene. The action takes place in the early hours of Thursday, the 21st of March 1963. The locale is the Hotel Kingston in Canberra, where a special session of the Federal Conference of the ALP has been underway since the start of the week. The party's six state branches are each represented by six delegates. Six times six equals 36. Some of the delegates of the conference, such as Don Dunstan, are elected politicians, but the 36 delegates are, for the most part, senior office holders in the party or in the affiliated unions. Now, the special conference is meeting at a time when Labor's prospects are, in fact, promising. Thanks to the big Labor split of the mid-1950s, Labor had been in opposition federally since 1949, but it almost snatched victory in 1961. Arthur Corwell, its parliamentary leader, is just about to publish a book called Labor's Role in Modern Society. Labor is not afraid of the future in March 1963. And Arthur Corwell, at the time, was not a loser. That month's special conference, March 1963, has been summoned to determine party policy on a proposal by the Menzies government to let the United States set up a defence communications base in Western Australia. The ALP's federal conference, and not the parliamentary party, is the ultimate authority in deciding party policy. In accordance with Labor's then prevailing concept of internal democracy, Arthur Corwell does not have a vote at the conference. Sentiment among the actual voting delegates is finally balanced. Half are ready to accept the US base and half are meant to oppose it. Proceedings drag on all through Wednesday, the 20th of March, and on after midnight as the delegates crawl towards an all too predictable compromise. They will do the right thing politically by Arthur Corwell and accept the US base, though with conditions. The next election, let us remember, is not due until December 1964, by which time Labor hopes that the night's proceedings in internal democracy will be long forgotten, allowing Arthur Corwell to fight the election on more amenable domestic issues. Alan Reid is one of the journalists covering the conference. For weeks he has been hoping for a ready-made story of crisis and discord to come out of the proceedings and for it to be topped off by a familiar Daily Telegraph headline along the lines of, say, conference deadlocked, split looms. But instead, it is looking likely that the conference, with a fix in the offing, will hardly be special at all. Reid, though, has not given up all hope. He is used to working well into the night. There is still enough time for something untoward to happen. And, this being the Labor Party, it does. At about 12:30 a.m, Reid discovers that something interesting has just happened. Arthur Corwell and his deputy Gough Whitlam have been whisked over from Parliament House in a Commonwealth car and are now waiting outside the Hotel Kingston. They are trying to find out how things are progressing. They can be seen standing under a street lamp seeking information from delegates who have absented themselves from the talk fest going on inside. Reid knows that a strong leadership team, as popularly conceived, would never be seen behaving in such a way. He knows that the scene must be immortalised by a photographer. There is, though, not a single press photographer present at the Hotel Kingston at this time of night. Now, the press photographers were not being notably derelict. The assumption was, and everyone believed it, the assumption was that the night was just going to be a non-event. Now, this absence of photographers, though inevitable, is nonetheless very frustrating for Reed. An historic photo opportunity looks like going begging. Reed, however, is not disconsolate for long. A friend who can help him turns up. A scientific photographer employed at the Australian National University named Vladimir Perel is among the throng at the Hotel Kingston. Perel, it seems, is present in his moonlighting capacity as a part-time taxi driver looking for a fare as the conference winds down. Vladimir is known as Val to his friends, who incidentally include Alan Reed. The two men love to go fishing together in the trout streams near Canberra. They're both great outdoorsmen. Reed certainly would have told his friend about the conference and perhaps even suggested that fares would be available as it neared its end. So, because of his friend's not accidental presence, Reed alone among the waiting journalists is in a position to arrange for embarrassing photographs to be taken. As soon as Reed spots Perel, he asks him to drive home at once, presumably in his taxi, and come back with a flashlight and start taking photographs of Corwell and Whitlam still standing under the street lamp. And time is on his side. Because the month is March, nights in Canberra are still relatively mild. Corwell and Whitlam, though unimpressed by the delay, are able to remain outside the Hotel Kingston without freezing to death. During a goodly period, they can huddle with notable delegates such as Joe Chamberlain, the power broker from Perth, or the embattled Queensland State ALP leader, Frank Duggan. And all the while, Val is taking pictures. At 1:45 a.m, the faceless men agree to accept the US base. 19 delegates vote yes, and 17 vote no, after Frank Duggan switches his vote. The 36 faceless men, if truth be told, are not a single solid block. Corwell seemingly is off the hook, but the story has moved on. The big story coming out of the conference is not going to be about the success of Corwell and Whitlam in getting party approval for the US base. The big story is going to be about Corwell and Whitlam's subservience to the forces of darkness, as demonstrated for all to see by photographs taken of them outside the Hotel Kingston, waiting to receive instructions about a vital national security issue from the faceless men within. After the conference ends, Val Perel dashes off in his taxi to his dark room at the Australian National University to develop his photographs. He then drives to Parliament House and gives the photographs to Reed. They are sent to Sydney on the first flight out of Canberra on Thursday morning. The more dramatic of the photographs are chosen for publication. On the following morning, a Friday, the selected photographs appear in the Daily Telegraph. The newspaper's owner, Frank Packer, because he is pro-Menzies, is mightily pleased. His wily pressman has pulled off a coup. Reed had turned dross into gold by pursuing his usual working methods to the nth degree. Journalism for Reed was never a matter of passively reporting one externally imposed news event after another. He was, as we have seen, a frustrated novelist, a frustrated artist, and was keen, whenever possible, to inject a strong narrative and vivid characters into his stories. The Faceless Men story resulted from Reed seizing the greatest ever of his artistic opportunities. In keenly crafting a lasting association between Arthur Corwell and dark images of anxiety and frustration, Reed succeeded beyond measure. A few months later, on the back of the special ALP conference, Prime Minister Menzies called a snap election. There were other issues in the election, such as state aid for Catholic schools, but ultimately all questions seemed to lead back to the power of the faceless men. And as you can see from the Liberal Party handout that has just been distributed, the Menzies government relied on the assertion that Arthur Corwell was not fit to become Prime Minister of Australia because he was a pawn of Labor's faceless men. Menzies was re-elected amid fear and dread, a mood compounded by the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The parliamentary majority of the Menzies government shot up from 2 to 20. Labor was destabilised, and as a result, an even bigger defeat followed in 1966. After internal reform designed to lessen the taint of the faceless men and two more elections, Labour, with new policies and led by Gough Whitlam, finally was able to manage to get back into office after 23 years in the wilderness. By then, Labour was so used to defeat that it found the business of government beyond its capabilities. The dismissal by Sir John Kerr duly followed. This turbulent period haunted Australian politics for decades to come. Arguably, it still does. Creating the story of the faceless men was clearly a major event, and as such is worthy of learned interpretation. In plumbing its significance, one point in particular needs to be emphasised, and this is the crux of tonight's address. Alan Reid, it is submitted, was something of a faceless man himself. He believed that power was best exercised behind the scenes. His ambition was to be Machiavelli, not the prince, the instructor, not the instructed, a faceless man in point of fact. An early devotee of Labour Party infighting, Reid never wanted to hold an elected position, but was more than willing to be given an influential backroom role, subtly advising party leaders. Initially, the only leaders that mattered for Reid were Labour leaders, but in time this position altered. Reid's links with Labour dated back to the early 1930s, when, like many other Australians at the time, he was unemployed. He travelled around New South Wales looking for work. Reid acquired a belief during the Depression in the need, whenever unemployment loomed, for government, the federal government, to intervene in the economy. His political hero during the Depression was Labour's Jack Lang. As a budding journalist, Reid ably leveraged his pro-Lang views. The first politician he knew at first hand was a local Lang Labour stalwart named Solomon Walsh, who I think was Max Walsh's uncle. When Reid first arrived in Canberra as a journalist, his source for major stories was Jack Beasley, known as Stabber Jack to his friends, the leading Labour federal Langite. It was Beasley and not a timid John Curtin who masterminded the termination of Robert Menzies' first spell as Prime Minister in 1941. Reid's articles on the fall of Menzies drew on information from Beasley. These articles powered him to a top position in the press gallery. In 1941, Reid was included in the select group of senior journalists who received confidential briefings on wartime developments from Prime Minister Curtin. A rather different Labour contact in the 1940s was the Melbourne numbers man Pat Kennelly, with whom Reid loved to trade stories about internal machinations in the party and electoral prospects. Reid also was close to Don Rogers, perhaps Labour's first spin doctor as press secretary to both Curtin and his post-1945 successor Ben Chifley. Reid's rivals in the press corps in Canberra resented this friendship with Rogers. They considered that it provided Reid with unfair access to the very latest inside information. And then there was Ben Chifley. Reid admired Chifley's nation-building schemes after World War II. Chifley's policies demonstrated to Reid's satisfaction that it was possible for middle-of-the-road socialists to navigate safely between the shoals of unfettered capitalism and communism. Chifley and Reid had many a tete-a-tete in Canberra's then intimate and cosy Parliament House. At one stage, it seems that they even discussed the possibility that Reid, a signed-up member of the Australian Labor Party, might wish to stand as ALP candidate when federal parliamentary representation was restored to the disenfranchised denizens of Canberra in 1949. Preferring a more discreet role as confidant, counsellor and confessor, Reid did not take up the offer. Reid loved having direct access to Ben Chifley. But any halcyonic period has to end, though, as the poets tell us. Reid's exposure to more bracing times in the 1950s reflected the impact of half a dozen people in particular: Menzies, Corwell, B.A. Santa Maria, Dr. Everett and his protege, Dr. John Burton, and Frank Packer. Menzies defeated Chifley in the December 1949 federal election. The new Prime Minister did not much care for political journalists and disliked Reid in particular. He considered that Reid was biased against him because of his known ALP connections. So Reid's friendly chats with the Prime Minister abruptly ceased. Chifley's irascible colleague Arthur Corwell was another source of hostility. Corwell, in direct contrast to Menzies, did not consider Reid to be pro-Labour at all. He was angered when a Reid story in the Sydney Sun featured unflattering comments about himself and Evatt in the lead-up to the December 1949 election. He demanded that Reid be expelled from the Australian Labour Party. Corwell was unhappy when Reid was not expelled. He remained determined to exact revenge. Bob Santa Maria, leader after 1941 of the secretive anti-communist organisation The Movement, was increasingly another worry. Reid was concerned when he began to hear rumours about the rise of the movement. Reid, unlike Santa Maria, was a lapsed Catholic and a middle-of-the-road socialist. The movement's ideas did not appeal to him at all. Yet another adverse development came in 1951 when Dr. Evatt succeeded Chifley as federal ALP leader. The new leader entered into a three-year marriage of convenience with anti-communist Labour politicians in Victoria. As part of this alignment, Evatt held secret meetings with Santa Maria. In the spring of 1954, Reid published the first extended newspaper coverage of Santa Maria's activities. After scoring an interview with Santa Maria, Reid repaid the favour by publishing lurid articles on the movement, one of which featured a photograph of Santa Maria sitting under a crucifix. Reid depicted Santa Maria as a Svengali-like figure whose swelling band of bewitched disciples was infiltrating the Labour Party. Reid's exposé was followed up by a momentous press release in which a panicky Dr. Evatt denounced the movement. Labour's anti-communist wing, known colloquially as the Groupers, was demonised after Evatt denounced Santa Maria. The breakaway Democratic Labour Party, established by ousted Groupers, directed its preferences to the Liberals. Labour's schism, for which he was in part responsible because he built up this image of Santa Maria, caused Reid to revise his list of allies and rivals. Until quite recently, he had resented the Svengali-like role of Bob Santa Maria. Following the split, he detected a new worrying figure influencing the ALP from behind the scenes, although this time operating with a left-wing agenda. Reid's new target was the on-again, off-again Evatt advisor, Dr. John Burton, who was trying to encourage Labour to forge a closer engagement with the newly decolonised nations in Asia. Reid, resenting the perceived influence of yet another rival backroom advisor, used stories in the Daily Telegraph to brand Burton's agenda as airy-fairy nonsense. Reid wrote for the Daily Telegraph and later on appeared on Channel 9 after Frank Packer headhunted him in 1954. A big advantage of this new job for Reid was that, as a senior Packer journalist, he gained access to the formerly chilly Prime Minister Menzies at crucial moments. Reid refused to comply when Packer asked him to resign from the Australian Labour Party, but otherwise their interests converged neatly. Packer was anti-Labour. Reid, politically, was now in effect an old believer and remained one to the end of his life. He deplored Labour's post-1954 leftwards lurch under Evatt and Burton. He saw it as a betrayal of the bread-and-butter verities of Ben Chifley. Dr. Evatt, though puzzled, was not embittered by Reid's new position in which he was writing endless unsympathetic stories for the Daily Telegraph. Reid appreciated the fact that Evatt, whatever his faults, was always willing to talk freely and candidly with him. There was a frank discussion between them in 1955, this is in the book, in which Evatt explicitly acknowledged that his attack on Santa Maria had a deliberate sectarian intent. In the wake of the trauma of the mid-1950s, many a grassroots Labour Party supporter regarded Reid as the mendacious stooge of Frank Packer. Such hostility, however, tended to be stifled in the cosy confines of Canberra. Most federal Labour politicians maintained a good professional relationship with the wily pressman. Everyone in Canberra knew that Reid could be trusted to maintain confidentiality. Any animus from Labour was channeled through Arthur Corwell, who never let up in his efforts to get Reid kicked out of the Australian Labour Party. In 1957, Reed finally allowed his ALP membership to lapse. Nothing that happened thereafter did anything to alleviate things between Reed and Corwell. In 1960, Corwell succeeded Evatt as leader of the Federal Labour Party. His deputy was Gough Whitlam. Whitlam's famed wit was too cutting for Reed's liking. It was a barrier. So Reed had little sympathy for Labour's latest leadership team. His days as a backroom confidant were gone for good. Now, this lack of rapport became crucial once the political contest in Australia evened up after the unelectable Evatt finally retired as ALP leader. A range of crucial factors can swing an election when the two rival camps are finally balanced. Arthur Corwell, let us remember, came close to defeating the Menzies government in the federal election held at the end of 1961. Voters resented the unemployment caused by a recent government-induced credit squeeze. Near the end of the campaign, Reed bluntly told Frank Packer that things were going very badly for the Liberals. They were going to lose. Menzies was just so complacent. Packer thereupon asked Menzies to have an urgent discussion with Reed. The pressman put a proposal to the Prime Minister that could not be refused. Reed advised Menzies to declare publicly that it was wrong for so many men and women to be out of work in Australia in 1961, and that in response his government intended to restore full employment without delay. Anything that Menzies did say on this issue, no matter how anodyne, would be played up for all that it was worth on the front page of the Daily Telegraph, with a supportive headline such as "No rest until all in jobs," and that headline duly appeared. And so Menzies did what he was told, and when he did win by two seats, Liberals in the know attributed the death-defying experience in some part to the intervention of Reed and Packer. After this near defeat in 1961, Liberal strategists realised that they had to switch the focus away from domestic issues and on to foreign policy and defence matters, where the ALP, still subject to left-wing pressure on national security issues, was vulnerable. This new strategy worked like a treat for a while. In 1962, Labor got bogged down in an internal debate on whether or not to endorse the idea of a nuclear-free zone in the Southern Hemisphere. Labor's related decision in March 1963 to call a special conference on the proposed US base in Western Australia again fitted in neatly with Menzies' wedging strategy. Yet despite its wrangling, Labor, if it acted diligently, might still hope to avoid being wedged. A last-minute fix at the special conference would defuse the debate on national security. As midnight ticked over on the 21st of March 1963, it seemed as if just such an act of self-preservation was about to be consummated. The good work would be undone only if something utterly out of the ordinary occurred, which is precisely what did happen as soon as Alan Reed clapped eyes on his photographic friend, Val Perel of the Hotel Kingston, and realised that the biggest story in his career was going to be about Arthur Corwell and Gough Whitlam standing under a street lamp waiting for their fate to be determined by 36 faceless men. Before concluding, we should recall that a great story and its characters are timeless. Alan Reed's faceless men of 1963 have never been forgotten, even though the role and composition of the ALP Federal Conference, their erstwhile standing ground, has been changed beyond recognition. Wherever power exists in an organisation or grouping, it is apt to get concentrated by one device or another in a few trusty hands. Oligarchy never dies, especially in the Labour Party and in its New South Wales branch in particular. I note in passing that Michael Costa has denounced his internal foes in the state party machine as faceless people at the height of the 2008 power privatisation crisis. And of course, we know that Mr Rudd is assisted by a gang of four, so oligarchy continues to thrive. So the latter-day counterparts of Alan Reid's faceless men live on in today's media in various guises. Factional heavyweights, unelected union officials, puppet masters, that's the latest cliche, backroom operators, power brokers, numbers men, call them what you will. The name may change, but the vital function of deploying internecine power continues, which means that Alan Reid's Machiavellian vision of Australian politics remains as instructive and entertaining as ever. And the full details are all in the new book published by myself and Ross Fitzgerald. And I will conclude on that. Thank you.
Many thanks, Stephen. As I said, Janet Grundy's outside, got some copies of Alan Reid, The Red Fox, and I'm sure the author and the co-author would be happy to sign them. So we go to question and discussion. We've got till no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. Can I just lead off? I came across briefly Alan Reid in the mid-70s and late-70s in Canberra, but even then, I mean, he was essentially an operator. But going back to the Bob Santa Maria story, the kind of behaviour that Reid got involved in for Winona now wouldn't really be acceptable. I mean, you quoted that famous statement that Evatt put out in October 54 that led to the Labour split of 54-55, but it was revealed by Robert Murray that not only did Reid report the story, but he helped Evatt draft the statement that led to the story which is subsequently reported. Now, how was that acceptable to a person like Reid in 1954? Now, if you just talk to the back of the room, okay?
Well, Reid, he was both politically committed to his vision of Labourism, as well as being a reporter of events and also a dedicated employer of Frank Packer. And all through 1954, he was determined to do his best to undo Santa Maria. Reid was very dependent on his sources, and his great source in Victoria was Pat Kennelly, the numbers man with a famous stammer. And Pat was in a savage war with the groupers, and so Reid was determined to, just in a subtle way, do his best to try and just build up fear of extreme Catholic action, fear of Santa Maria, in the hope that these extreme elements would be eliminated from the Labour movement and creating a more central position for the Labour Party. And that's why he would have agreed to help Evatt with his press statement. But in fact, Dr. Evatt just went over the top, and for various, just basically for mad sectarian reasons, he thought that if he denounced Catholic action and Catholic involvement generally, the Protestants would rally around him, but in fact that didn't happen. It just split the party and made it unelectable.
Thanks. So there's a question here. Yeah.
Do you think that Reid really enjoyed his Machiavellian role, and that really expressed his nature?
He said it was great fun, and everything that I've read about him indicates that it was.
Never had a moment of guilt about anything.
No guilt.
But what were these books like? You've no doubt read them. Mm. I mean, the novels, the unpublished novels, what were they like?
Oh, there was one unpublished novel. It is based on the split.
And a couple of plays.
Yeah, that's right. There's a play on the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And in fact, there was a play. Reid was a frustrated novelist. He had this novel but based upon the split, which he wrote and was not published, because people would fear that either Dr. Evatt or Mr. Santa Maria would launch a defamation suit. and so that his play was never got off the ground. His novel never got off the ground. But he tried various short stories, and he sent some to America, and they were unfortunately rejected. And he wrote various plays, one about the crucifixion of Jesus Christ from a political angle, but
and he gave them to Adams.
Yeah, but in fact, in 1975, Alan Reid did his play set in confines of Parliament House was in fact staged in Canberra in the winter of 1975, and it featured a gnomic small bureaucrat who's recognised to be Dr. Coombs. And so it's almost like in the Tudor period people used to stage plays just to denounce, in which their enemies were portrayed under kind of mythological or historical characters. And so Reed, in the mid-1970s, he restaged this play directed against, as far as I can see, against the influence of Dr. Coombs, because Reed was an old-fashioned Labour man, and he regarded Dr. Coombs as a kind of symbol of all the new ideas that were sleeping, you know, the permissiveness and the liberalising attitudes to sexuality, etc., that were sweeping into the Labour Party under in the Whitlam era.
Jeff, hang on just a second. Jeff Cordani. Oh, then Peter Collins. Jeff and then Peter.
Yeah. Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. I've got a bit of mixed back memories. I've given all the grey hairs in the audience. I hope many of you have got those memories all those times. The 36 Faces Men was a great political slogan. Alan Reid getting the photographer to take pictures of a great political coup in showing or in demonstrating from certainly from Packer's point of view that the Labour Party, its elected leaders were the subject of unelected people making decisions. Given the fact that, of course, the 36 Faceless Men had come up through a process from a vibrant party system at the time, I wonder whether in these days, when we've got a gang of four who make policy, or in the case of perhaps a parental leave where the leader makes policy on the run, are we any better off democratically under the present way think politics has run than we were when the 36 Faceless Men were around?
No, I don't.
Well, this is not exactly a question on Alan Reid, I think, is the answer, but you can answer it if you want to.
Well, as I said, in 1963, I think there's nothing new under the sun. I think what you more or less said, Arthur Crowell, his ghostwriter Graham Freudenberg, said in 1963, you know, that what happens in the party conference is in fact an internal democracy made by the people everyone understands their duty is to implement party policy.
Peter Coleman.
Just a question about that play you did. Was it a full-scale production in Canberra?
Yeah.
Was it not a play reading, a full production?
Yes, Canberra Repertory Society. Oh, about a week. It was reviewed in the Australian and the Bulletin. But I think it's fair to say that Reed will be remembered by his Machiavellian Chronicles rather than his plays and his unpublished novel, yeah.
So where did it play?
Just in Canberra in June 1975.
In a theatre in
Canberra? Yeah.
Okay, so there's a question here then, Stuart.
If you consider the political system and process as a whole, I have a simplistic maybe...
But the question's going to be on Alan Reid. Focus on Alan Reid.
Simplistic maybe a bit of a facetious question. I mean, Any political system has faceless men because you can call on a dozen or so advisers as well as consultants. So in your speech here, are these faceless men consultants or advisers?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So what's wrong with that?
I totally agree, and that's why this book on Reed is... It just shows that the faceless men of 1963, about whom Reed wrote and who are in this book, they live on today as consultants or whatever, you know, numbers men, apparatchiks, head office people. So it's just, you know, people, the accents are different. People don't get around in, you know, suede, you know, serge suits and short back and sides. You know, the outward apparel is... change, but you know the inner core, the inner dynamics is continuing as in the 50s or today or in Machiavelli's Florence.
So there's nothing unethical about it.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess Stuart, then Ross wants to make a comment. Stuart,
can you elaborate on his role in relation to John Gorton and Billy McMahon?
So there's a question about Ellen Reid and John Gorton and Billy McMahon. Yep.
Well, Reed had form, as I said, because of this association with Frank. Reed grew up as a Labour man, but as an employee of Frank Packer, that gave him access to the Liberals. And Frank Packer's chief liberal in Canberra was Billy McMahon, and so Reid kind of was expected to boost McMahon's career, if only by stamping out rumours that he was gay or strange or unconventional. And so this association, and so with that's what happened. I think Reid, as Packers man, was expected to boost McMahon, which more or less led him into collision with Gorton, because there was this clash between Gorton and McMahon, and that culminated in 1971 when Reid more or less was a full-time advisor to various termites, as they were called, in the Liberal Party, who were out to get rid of Gorton. And as Gorton's parliamentary majority declined, Reid was able to advise, four or five Liberals on just what to do. And Reid was often frustrated because he considered them the amateurs. He was the real expert. And Reid, got very worried and angry about how just amateurish these Liberals were in plotting against Gorton. But finally it paid off in March 1971 when, just Gorton said, "I've had enough of this," and resigned.
Ross?
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure to work with you, Stephen. Yeah. I've enjoyed it a great deal. I wonder whether you might tell the audience how we managed to track down who actually did take the photos and why that's important.
Well, I think, Ross, with his contacts with the media, was alerted. I think it was Stroop, wasn't it, that we were interested not just in archival stuff, surviving letters and transcripts, etc., but we're interested in talking to people who knew Reid and who had memories of them, and Ross talked to a lot of those. But there was one chap in Canberra, Ralph Weston, he emailed the Australian, and it was forwarded to us, and Ralph said that I know the full story of the 12 witless men. That was the executive, and eventually we twigged that he was referring to the 36 faceless men, and so we called him up, and he just said, I was a colleague of Vladimir Perel who took those photos. I was at the John Curtin Medical School on Thursday, and I saw these negatives hanging, still laying around, and I just... They're off the record, they're all... And Mr. Perel is no longer with us, so he can't be punished for this, but there were all these photographs which had obviously been taken for private purposes, and I asked him what was going on, and he just told me I'd taken these pictures for Alan Reid. And in chatting with Ralph Weston, the man who saw these photographs, just all the things came together. The common love, Perel and Reid had a common love of the outdoors life, if it was fishing or skiing or whatever. And so that just all the evidence was there that people never knew who'd actually taken the photographs, but thanks to this tip-off from one of Vladimir Perel's colleagues, we were able to actually find the man who took the photos. And Reid was very diligent in ensuring that the identity of this man was never revealed in his lifetime, because he could have been in trouble for what was theoretically or officially misuse of the resources of the Australian National University. But now that both Reid and Mr. Perel are no longer with us, I think it's just we can reveal who actually took those photos, and it just shows how the whole event, what an act of artistry and artifice it was.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.